Edward Bennett Williams has been known for his expertise as a trial lawyer. Many have attributed his success to his drive and force of personality, along with intelligence and good judgment. But Williams cites still another attribute, and that is creativity. I believe the practice of trial law is perhaps the most creative art. A trial lawyer stages a production that is designed to create an impression on a jury, and there is no opportunity for retakes, as in a movie. The trial lawyer has no backdrop, no lighting, no effects to create illusions. There is only the bare stage. Furthermore, the trial lawyer's creativity is curtailed. It has boundaries because a trial deals with truth, not fiction. That from the study, The Trial Lawyers by Emily Couric. At the same time that Williams compares the work of a lawyer in court to a theatrical performance without stage effects to create illusions, the ancient philosopher Plato once identified lawyers as the rivals of poets in that both are masters of illusion. Poets are composers of the same things as lawyers, rivals of each other, as artists and actors of the fairest drama, as Jody Enders reminds us. And Annette Simmons takes that a step further when she contends a storytelling lawyer activates the emotions and senses of a jury and invokes the power of drama to influence the decision. The timing and style of a prosecution attorney walking the alleged murder weapon around the courtroom can ignite the fears, horrors, and imaginations of the jury. They may be consciously concerned about the facts, but their subconscious mind is watching that gun and playing a story they imagine might have happened, complete with screams, blood, and emotion. If this story becomes real enough for them, they will find the facts to fit the story their subconscious already believes. Writer Lauren Stahl has created just such a lawyer in her new novel.
Kate needed to be alone with her thoughts, alone with the victims, and alone with the killer. Ignoring the beads of sweat that pricked at the back of her neck, she examined the photos taken at the first crime scene. The Mission County DA's office mandated that ADAs examine crime scenes to help prevent chain of custody issues and aid law enforcement in the procedural aspects of a case, which basically meant ensuring cases weren't lost on technicalities. Whether she had observed the scene firsthand or through a packet of photos, Kate had perfected the ability to recreate the crime for the jury. By the time she'd finished delivering her closing argument, the jury had seen, smelled, tasted, and above all feared, the way the victim had feared.
Writer Lauren Stahl reading from her new novel, The Devil's Song, just released yesterday as a Kaylee Jones book, published by Akashic Books in New York. Lauren Stahl has been a lawyer here in northeastern Pennsylvania, an assistant DA prosecuting felonies. She's a graduate of the Dickinson School of Law, and she has received an MFA from the Maslow Family Graduate Program in Creative Writing at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre, where she will read this Friday evening from her work. Her novel is set in Mission County, Pennsylvania, which we'll find bears a striking resemblance to Luzerne County. And Lauren Stahl stopped in at the WVIA studios to talk with us about bringing together law and literature in The Devil's Song.
Without a doubt, I would not be here without the Wilkes program. This book would have never, ever happened without Wilkes. And a lot of people help make that happen within the program. But the program itself, which is a low residency program, you are on campus twice a year in January and June. And other than that, once the on-campus days are over, you're home and it's up to you to be writing. And you're responsible for weighing in and making sure you meet deadlines and things like that. But it is really those 2 weeks that you are on campus that change your life. And I know that sounds so ridiculous, but it is so true. And another local writer, Cecilia Galante, turned me on to the program. And she said, you know, Lauren, I really think you should give it a shot, apply, see what happens. But, you know, this is a program that's amazing. It's in our backyard. And I was very honest with her. I said, you know, I don't know much about it. She then, you know, proceeds to tell me I apply and I was accepted. I then go to the program and it was just mind-blowing, the amount of talent. And I'm not talking about just the students, but I mean the faculty. amazing, amazing people and writers, and they're on campus twice a year and doing readings at Barnes & Noble, the Wilkes-Barre Barnes & Noble, and the Dart Center, and they're right here in our backyard, and half of us don't even know about it. Amazing. So I really have to give all the credit to the program and then the people within the program that really kind of took me under their wing.
Were you always writing stories and poems as a little one?
Yes. Growing up, my siblings kind of joke with me, and they always say, whenever they're retelling a story, like a childhood story, and it's something really fun, and they're talking about what they did, and I'll say, you know, well, where was I? And it's always, oh, you were reading. You were writing your stories. You missed out on everything because you were reading. And now I say, look where we're at. So it's a good thing I was reading. Sometimes, if I'm being honest with you, I'd wake up in the middle of the night and just feel compelled to write something. So I kept a spiral notebook next to my bed my whole life. I still do. And, you know, sometimes I would go months without writing anything. And then there'd be a period of time where it was just nonstop and on very little sleep. So.
And all kinds of things, adventure stories and intimate things.
A lot of horrible poetry, if you could even call it that. And then sometimes it would be as silly as a to-do list where I would then kind of insert these random little creative blurbs within the to-do list, which my mom has kept to this day, some of them. It's so embarrassing, but it's true. And then it kind of just evolved into stories. And then from there, I read crime and thrillers. Like, I mean, I could finish them a night at a time, especially before I had kids. And so I was very, very, very obsessed with that genre. And it just seemed like a natural bridge into writing that.
Well, we read in your bio that you went to law school and that you were an assistant DA. So you've been a practicing lawyer. What drew you in?
Law school was exciting to me because of what would follow. I was very excited to be in a courtroom. I was very excited to perform, if you will, in front of a jury and kind of need to be on my feet and quick thinking. And I wasn't always successful, but that was exciting to me. Something that would never get old in a profession where you're helping people, but you're doing it in such a way that was very intriguing to me. And so that was kind of the law school thing, and then it just seemed a natural progression into the DA's office where it is baptism by fire. You're in the courtroom in week one, they hand you a box and they say, go ahead, you know, go at it. So that was exciting.
Did you take notes along the way and say, oh, that would make a good story, or that's a great character? How did that fit in?
I did not. There was one case that we had that I had that went to trial, myself and another assistant district attorney at the time. And it was the only case, I would say, in the short 2 years or just shy of 2 years that I was in the DA's office that really stuck with me and prevented me from sleeping and had me really uneasy. And most cases I was able to go in, do the best job that I could do to represent the Commonwealth, and then leave it. And whatever the outcome was, I did the best I could do, and that was that. And this case, I just remember I would be in bed at night thinking, oh my goodness, if this doesn't have the right outcome, if this doesn't receive a guilty verdict, I don't know what I will do. It was the only case in, you know, the 2 year period I was there that really, like I said, left me really uneasy. And so that, when I started writing The Devil's Song, while this is completely fictional, it was kind of that case, that trial, that stuck with me and kind of started shaping the idea for this. But again, much, much a work of fiction.
But the sense of you're being preoccupied to the point,
yes,
of lying in
that
bed.
That was it. Yep.
You tell us in the novel how the professionals talk about the case and call it reds because that helps keep that distance. Are you trained in law school how to be a professional and keep your distance in a healthy way from the cases?
I was not. That very much came with the job. And I can tell you, my father-in-law recently read the book, and I hadn't told him much. I mean, here and there, bits and pieces, but he read an advanced copy, and he called me and he said, you know, when I was in the DA's office, he was in the DA's office in Bucks County, and he said, we did the exact same thing. We had these monikers and these ways of desensitizing, and he gave me a couple examples of different names they would use, and I thought that was interesting. But never in law school. Did not learn that in law school.
Where is this Mission County in your imagination? Is it partly here?
So if you ask my editor and the amazing Kaylee Jones, the imprint, she will tell me it is very much here. It is absolutely Luzerne County. I guess she's right, but I tried. I felt like it was a rural area, maybe even a bit more so than here. But yes, I mean, certainly when I'm picturing a courthouse, I'm writing what I know. I'm picturing this courthouse, our beautiful Luzerne County courthouse. And so those types of things, yes, very much here.
And when we're in this amazing library and it has three floors and it has stained glass windows, well, I'm thinking Oosterhout Library in downtown Wilkes-Barre.
Aren't you? Me too. Yeah, I think, you know, I there's some really beautiful places here and some really fun, interesting places. And why not write about those things that we know and kind of expand on it and make it either a little less beautiful or even more beautiful to write the book.
When I was reading that scene, not only did I think, oh, Oosterhout Library, but I also felt the way you used the language there in the description of the stained glass windows and the multiple floors and moving back and forth in the stacks. It felt to me like that was a good image or a good metaphor for what you're able to do here, because the story is a complex one. Layering, weaving, multiple reflections, different dimensions. And I thought, that's what Lauren's doing in this novel, and it's a very good image of that.
Yes, I appreciate that you noticed that. And that library scene is at such an integral part of the book, and it's such this heightened part of the book that I love that you picked up on that, because that's so huge, right?
It really is. Kaylee Jones is an estimable figure. She's a writer and an editor, and she has the imprint, a teacher. Did you work with her as your mentor?
Yes, we were matched, and I am so thankful for that. And she took me under her wing, and I would write and write and write and submit to her, sometimes chapter by chapter, sometimes multiple chapters. And this, at this point, you know, we weren't looking to publish this. I was just writing, and Kaylee was my mentor. And I got done with the book, and she said, you know, Lauren, I think this is publishable. She didn't have her imprint at this point. And she was kind enough to pass the book along to her agent with the understanding of the agent would just be getting back to me and kind of giving me some notes but not looking to rep me. And it kind of all just went from there. It all unraveled very quickly and yet took years to get to this point of it being published and sitting on the desk right now.
It's due out January 2nd?
Yes. Some people are receiving copies already from Amazon, but the official publication date is January 2nd. Surreal. Completely surreal.
Wow. And it's wonderful that you're able, as a writer, to create flesh and blood characters who swear, as well as being terrified in bed with these awful dreams and caring about solving this, not just because it's a puzzle, but because people's lives are at stake. Did these people come to you and form themselves in conversation with you? Sometimes writers tell us at this table, oh no, they took on a life of their own.
It's creepy, right? Because it really happens. It's totally creepy. I never understood that until I was in the middle of the first draft of this book, and it got to the point that I was no longer dictating what these characters were going to do. I would wake up and they were telling me. I know that sounds ridiculous, but it is so true. And I became so attached to these characters that when the book was done, I remember calling Kaylee and I said, I feel like I just lost my family. Like, we need to write another one because this is horrible. And, you know, she kind of laughed at me and she said, that's the process. You know, that's what happens. And the swearing, it's funny you mentioned that. That is complete thanks to Kaylee Jones. When I would write this character, I was worried that the protagonist wouldn't be likable or relatable enough, or maybe a little too rough around the edges and didn't have that cozy type of personality that you could really attach to. And I voiced that concern to Kaylee, and we did, you know, there were a few edits that were made to calm it down a little bit, but she was the one that championed this, and she said, we want a soldier, and she doesn't have to be likable to everyone, but she is relatable, and this is okay if she's swearing, and this is okay if she's wearing a skirt that's a little too short for court because of a certain reason, or, you know, whatever that may be. Hey, that's life. And so thanks to Kaylee, you know, she really allowed me to develop that character how I wanted to.
And how about the title, The Devil's Song? Were you able to choose the title?
I was. It was not the original title. And then as I kept revising the book, which was a long process, originally the title was something else. And then as I kept revising and I was seeing these hints and these little, blurbs jumping out at me, I thought, this is it. I mean, this killer, if you want to say, antagonist, one of the antagonists, he's singing to her. And what he's singing isn't pretty. And so it kind of just fell into place.
And I wanted to go back to your being a little one and waking up in the middle of the night and having your notebook and scribbling things down, and the sense of the characters beginning to shape themselves and telling you about what they were going to be up to as the story unfolds. That's all part of creativity and the creative process of trusting and tapping into that unconscious or subconscious, not always the rational mind. And dreams form a very important part in the story. Whether the good or the bad or the terrible part, it's all in there.
Yes, and those dark moments were dark. In fact, there were times where I would go back and reread a chapter that I had written, and I would think to myself, When did I write that? You just kind of lose yourself to the book and the characters, and that means the good, bad, and the ugly.
And the dreams function how, then, in the course of the story?
In the book, it was a way for me to be able to go back without actually going back in time and just being able to give the reader snippets without having to give this whole big backstory and, what was going on. It was just a way for me to build tension by showing that there was this major traumatic event that happened, and let's start trying to piece it together without getting too bogged down in all of it right away.
It keeps everything moving, and it's like a weaving of this thread and that thread.
Yes, I tried to get us in and out of scenes as quickly as possible with giving the information that was necessary, but not, like I said, bogging us down in all the details. So from a plotting perspective, I just wanted to get into the scene, develop it, and quickly get out, move to the next chapter so that you wanted to keep reading. Essentially, like, you know how we binge on Netflix? That's essentially what I was looking to do.
Is there a next?
I hope so. I mean, I would be very lonely without Kate Magda in my life. So I have started the next book in the series, and it's just a matter of getting it done with a 2-year-old, an 8-month-old, and, life, as they say. But yes, I am actively working on it and happily actively working on it.
What about the relationships, just the human interrelationships? Yes, maybe between and among the genders and so forth, but that's all part of who they are as real people.
Yes, and again, as silly as this sounds, a lot of those characters dictated that to me. So I didn't wake up thinking, okay, well, this person's going to, end up falling in love with this person, and he's not a great guy, but it kind of just happened. And I think that's what happens in life, too. We don't plan to deviate between, beyond the picket white fence and the fam, but things happen, and life happens. And so I wanted the book to be as realistic as possible with that, and the characters kind of did that for me.
And Tess is a fascinating character.
I struggle with Tess. I dislike her and I love her at the same time, but I have a hard time with Tess. And writing her was hard. On one hand, I wanted to tell her to grow up and, be more mature about things. And then on the other hand, she's so damaged and she's so fragile, and she is still this immature person that is dealing with so much and dealing with it poorly that, your heart kind of breaks for her. And so it's that balance of, man, I don't really care for her. I wouldn't want to be her friend in real life. But this is heartbreaking, what she's struggled with.
Who are some of your mentors that you just think are masterful storytellers?
I think someone on the younger side would be Alifair Burke. She writes in this genre, and she, I think, is masterful. She has an ability to tell a story quickly to keep the pace going, where you also have character development, which I think is tough. That's a tough balance between plotting and character, and she does a very nice job with that. And she also has just crushed it with the strong female protagonist, and that is my goal. So when I'm When I was writing the Devil Song, that's what I wanted. And I think she's someone who does that so well, and she's so gifted with that. So she'd be someone that I would recommend to anyone.
Do you have something you'd like to read for us?
I would love to read something for you. I think the only setup that this needs is that Reds is the case name that has been given to the string of serial murders happening in Mission County. I think everything else will fall into place. Kicking off her heels, Kate paced the length of the conference room, a stack of photos in hand, imagining she was at the crime scene, barefoot, cold, just like the victims. Next, she picked up a picture of victim one, a 20-something redhead who, like the other victim, had been found naked and dumped in a cemetery. Kate glossed over the matted red hair, clenched facial muscles, and bruised bottom lip. She then took a closer look at the victim's face. Not her face donning a smile like the one that had been used in the newspaper, but her face as she'd taken her last breath. Kate focused on the black trail of tears that stained the victim's cheeks. The woman had known she was going to die. She had stopped fighting. Tears didn't have a place in a fight for survival. Kate knew this from experience. Thoughts entered Kate's mind, thoughts she didn't want to admit to thinking, thoughts that had her now frantically searching the crime scene photographs until she had a clear shot of the victim's hands, more importantly, her nails. Each photo showed her nails still intact, practically clean. The victim hadn't struggled, thought Kate, at least not in the grave. Had she been alive when she was dumped in the grave, she would have clawed at the dirt walls in an attempt to climb out, to save herself. Her fingers would have been bloody, scratched, ripped open, like Kate's had been a long, long time ago. She closed her eyes and shook her head to clear the cobwebs of her past, knowing it would take much more than a headshake. The dark of Kate's eyelids reminded her of that night. And then, like a slideshow on an old projection screen, the images appeared, fuzzy and faded, but she saw them nonetheless. A child's hand clawing at the dirt wall, a shovel spearing the rocky earth, his chin-length salt-and-pepper hair stuck to his sweat-stained face. Blackness. Kate's eyes flew open, her tongue so dry she couldn't unglue it from the roof of her mouth. Her hands were poised in front of her like claws. She moved her body toward the wall, butting herself against it and then using it to steady herself as she slid to the floor. Her mind was still focused on the past and the blackness of that night. It was in that blackness, when the space between life and death had blurred, when the seconds had felt like hours and she'd realized that life as she once knew it was no longer, that Kate had heard him singing to her, his voice a deep baritone that passed through the earth, streamed through her ears and into her head as the dirt and gravel piled around her, suffocating her. Kate attempted to still her racing mind. Wasn't the real reason Kate was uneasy about this case more than an attempt to take down a serial killer? Wasn't it more than the career doors it could open or close? The real reason involved night terrors, which had recently returned, and thousands of dollars in therapy, which she should probably start up again. Not to mention how the lack of sleep was now affecting her during the day, too, seemingly unable to shake the constant feeling that she was viewing life through a dense fog and the bouts of dizziness she'd been experiencing. 27 years later, either her PTSD was acting up or he had returned for her. To finish what he'd failed to do all those years ago, Kate had a feeling, like a twisting fist inside her gut, that he was murdering these women to lure her, trap her. He had come back singing for her, the devil's song that only he could sing.
Writer Lauren Stahl, reading from her new novel, The Devil's Song, just released yesterday as a Kaylee Jones book published by Akashic Books in New York. Lauren Stahl has been a lawyer here in northeastern Pennsylvania, an assistant DA, and she is a graduate of the Dickinson School of Law. She's received an MFA from the Maslow Family Graduate Program in Creative Writing at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre. The Maslow Foundation Salon Reading Series, which highlights the January 2018 residency for the Graduate Program in Creative Writing, features debut authors, program faculty, and prize-winning authors as guest readers. And the series will open this Friday, January 5th, with a special event featuring readings by 4 Creative Writing Program alumni whose first books are debuting in 2018, and that includes Lauren Stahl. That reading will start at 7:30 p.m. in the ballroom of the Henry Student Center on the campus of Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre. It is free and open to the public. For more information, on the web, wilkes.edu, wilkes.edu. The Wilkes University Maslow Foundation Salon Reading Series will run from January 5th through the 11th, and there are details on the website about the various events each evening and the various locations. But the Friday, January 5th reading at 7:30 p.m. will take place in the Henry Student Center Ballroom, and that's 84 West South Street on the Wilkes campus in Wilkes-Barre, and will include Lauren Stahl reading from her work. For more information on the web, wilkes.edu, wilkes.edu.